Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And we're asking him all the questions we could think of about the end of the world in the 2 hours we've got with him. And I mentioned a word, a couple words.
Two words.
At the beginning. And Jimmy's like, pay off. You got to pay. If you tease, you got to pay off. And so let me pay that off. Two words we often hear.
I hate it when I'm listening to radio hosts, like late night radio or something, and I don't do this much anymore, but I did in the day, and I'd hear the hosts tease what they're going to ask the guest, and it's like, oh, I want to hear the answer to that, yeah. And then they never get around to asking the question they teased.
I'm looking at you, George Norrie. I am looking at you, George. Yeah. Come on. All right, so we teased it, and there are two words that are often seem like it anyways. They are associated with the end times, and if I remember, they are Saskatoon and Saskatology. Is that did I get that correct?
It's your Spanish is interfering with your English there because Spanish doesn't like S's on the fronts of words, so it wants to put an E on the front of them, like, so school becomes escuela.
I never made that association with Spain. You're right. Yeah.
And it's not Spain, it's España.
And so is Esteban.
Esteban, yeah. So they don't like S on the front of a word in Spain. And that's what we got going on here. It's not scatology, which is a real word.
Oh, I didn't mean to open that Pandora's box of flavor and smells.
Gotta give the audience closure. So scatology, the ology part comes from logia, which means a speech, and in modern English, it's come to mean study of. So scatology is the study of scat. So the question is, what's scat? Well, it is. It's in some contexts, it's the nonsense syllables that jazz singers sometimes produce. So like the shoopity bop da bop da bop bop bop, that kind of thing, that is scat. And Scatman Crothers, assume.
Must have been good at it.
Must have been good at it, yeah. But it also means excrement. And so scatology is the study of excrement. But when we put the E on the front of it, eschatology, it means something different. So in Greek, eschatos means last. And so eschatology is the study of the last things. Now, there's two kinds of eschatology. One is what's sometimes called personal eschatology, and that's what are the last things for an individual, like death, judgment, hell, heaven. Those are the four last things in personal eschatology. You could also add purgatory in there as a fifth one. But there is corporate eschatology or general eschatology, which is the study of the last things of the world, not of an individual like you or me, but of the entire world. And that involves things like the Antichrist and the Second Coming and the resurrection of the dead and the Last Judgment. All those are part of general eschatology. Then there was the other word you teased, which was eschaton. And eschaton is just the neuter form of eschatos. In Greek, eschatos or last, that's masculine, because you can hear it because of the S on the end, eschatos. But when you put a new on the end of it, so it becomes eschaton, it's the neuter form, and it just means the end. So the eschaton is the end. And if you go back to the late 1960s, you'll find some people who identified themselves as Discordians, who it was kind of a joke religion that worshipped the goddess Eris or Discord from Greek and Roman mythology. And one of their slogans, because they're chaotic, they worship chaos, is they wanted to bring about the end of the world. And so one of their slogans was, "Immanentize the eschaton."
I'm so glad they did not succeed in their,
yeah.
in their quest. All right. So then if we're going to talk about the eschaton, is the rapture?
We have been for an hour.
Yeah. Is the rapture part of it? Is that a real thing? And how should we respond to this rapture theology that's all around us?
Well, it depends on what you mean. Okay. So there is an event that St. Paul describes in 1 Thessalonians 4:17 that has been called the rapture. Now, raperimur in Latin means to be caught away. And so that's where the idea of that's where the term rapture comes from. This is not a term that's in the Bible. It's a Latin term, and it means it actually can also mean to kidnap. But it also means to catch away. And there is a passage in 1 Thessalonians 4 where St. Paul is talking about how at a certain point in time in the future, believers in Christ will be caught up to be with Christ and meet him in the air. Mm-hmm. The context in which St. Paul is saying this, now you got to understand a little bit of the backstory of St. Paul's history with the Church of Thessalonica. He did go to Thessalonica, and he founded a church there. You can read about this in the book of Acts. But he only got to stay there for 3 weeks because the Jews in the city had a riot, and he had to get out of Dodge. And he ended up going down to Athens, which is on the same peninsula that Thessalonica is, just down the peninsula from Thessalonica. And he was very anxious about what's going to happen with his converts that he was with for only 3 weeks. I mean, can you imagine how much of the, if you had not been a Christian,
wow, yes.
how much of the Christian faith would you have learned in 3 weeks? Well, he was concerned about them and their faith, and he was afraid they were going to fall away since he didn't have the chance to stabilize them in their faith. And so he was overjoyed when he got word that, hey, they're sticking with the faith, they still believe in Jesus, and so forth. And he thus wrote 1 Thessalonians when he got this word that they're doing okay in their faith. But they had some misunderstandings because he hadn't been able to teach them very much. And one of the things they had was apparently the idea, because, you know, you need to repent before Jesus comes back. And if you want to participate in his kingdom, remember, that's the gospel. You need to repent and turn back to him. And the Thessalonians had gotten this idea, and you need to do that before you die. They'd gotten the idea that in order to participate in Jesus's kingdom, you need to be alive at the time he comes back. And they were concerned because at least somebody, maybe several somebodies in the Thessalonian church had died after Paul's visit. And they were afraid that, oh man, you know, Bob and Alice died. They're not going to get to be part of Christ's kingdom. They're not going to be alive when he comes back. And so St. Paul was writing to comfort them and say, no, don't worry about Bob and Alice. It's going to be okay for them. And so he tells them in 1 Thessalonians 4 that actually when Christ returns, the dead in Christ will rise first, and only then will we living Christians be caught up to be with Jesus in the air. And then we'll always get to be with Jesus, so we're not going to be left abandoned. We're always going to be with him. It's going to be great. Don't worry, and don't worry about Bob and Alice and anybody else who's died. Now, Ted and Carol, they might be a different matter, but Bob and Alice, they're going to be okay.
1970s so, film reference, in case anyone's wondering.
A film I've actually never seen.
I don't think I have either.
Yeah. But so that's what he's doing here. What he does not do is say, well, once we get caught up and we're always going to be with the Lord, what happens next? And according to that school I mentioned at the top of hour number one, dispensationalism, what's going to happen is Jesus is going to do a U-turn. He's going to come down. The dead are Christians are going to be raised. The living Christians are going to be caught up with him. And then he's going to do a U-turn and go right back to heaven and stay there for a number of years, commonly 7 years, sometimes 3.5 years. And while he's doing that, all hell's going to break out on earth. This is a period called the tribulation. Tribulation is just a fancy word. It means trouble. So this is the time of great trouble. And the Antichrist is going to be doing bad stuff and so forth. And then finally, at the end of the tribulation, Jesus is going to come down out of heaven and squash the Antichrist and reign on earth for 1,000 years, physically present on earth for 1,000 years before the actual end of the world. And then at the end of the 1,000 years, there's going to be a final unleashing of the forces of evil. And then we're going to get the general resurrection of the dead and the last judgment and the beginning of the eternal order. So the people who actually use the word rapture for this event in 1 Thessalonians are viewing it as part of a larger complex of events where after the rapture, people go back up to heaven and stay there during the tribulation, and then they come back for a 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth, followed by the final unleashing of the forces of evil and the last judgment and all that stuff. So people who use the term rapture for this event are presupposing this whole complex of events. And so I can understand it if someone who does not believe the whole complex wants to say, hey, I don't believe in the rapture.
I see, yeah, because you're using it as shorthand for the whole thing.
Yeah, for the whole thing.
Yeah.
Whereas you could be confusing someone into thinking you believe all this big complex model when really you don't. But I can also understand someone, and I tend to do this myself, saying, well, yeah, there's this event in 1 Thessalonians 4 where believers get caught up to be with Jesus. And if you want to call it the rapture, that's fine with me. And so I would say I don't have a problem saying there's a rapture. We just need to understand it correctly. And then I'll go on to explain how I think we need to understand it. So I always like to follow St. Paul's instructions to Timothy, where he tells Timothy to remind his congregations not to fight about words.
Yeah.
Because it only ruins the hearers. And so, you know, if you don't have time to explain, then I'd say, yeah, or if you don't have the knowledge needed to explain, then yeah, you could just say, I don't believe in the rapture. But if you do have time to explain, I tend to want to embrace people and say, yeah, I don't have any problem with the idea of the rapture. We just need to understand it correctly. So what's the correct understanding? Well, as I mentioned, dispensationalism is only about 200 years old. So previous Christians, including the Protestant reformers, did not believe that whole theory I just sketched out about there's going to be a rapture and a tribulation and 1,000. And they didn't buy that whole theory. Some would believe pieces of it. Like some thought that there would be a future earthly reign of Christ for 1,000 years before the final end, but nobody had this specific sequence. And what everybody historically understood the rapture to be was what was going to happen at the second coming. And that's clear from 1 Thessalonians, and it's clear from 2 Thessalonians, where Paul goes into the same events in more detail. And he talks about, because they didn't, after 1 Thessalonians, they had 3 weeks of instruction plus one letter. They still weren't really solid on a bunch of stuff. And so he talks about the same issue again in 2 Thessalonians. And he makes it really clear that this event where we're caught up to be with Christ, that's going to be at the end of the world, at the second coming, at least. And so so it's not going to be what's called a pre-tribulation rapture, where he takes Christians out of the world before the tribulation.
Got it.
We're going to go through the tribulation, and then Jesus is going to come back and rescue us. So what happens after the tribulation? Well, Jesus is not going to do a U-turn. He's going to inaugurate his reign, whether you understand that as an earthly millennium or as the eternal order. He's going to inaugurate his reign when he comes back. And you might say, well, then why get if he's just going to come down to earth and reign, you know, whatever reign it's going to be, why does it talk about us being caught up to be with him and meet him in the air? And this is something that relies on a piece of first century culture that moderns know nothing about. Today, when a, let's say, a world leader visits a place, you know, they'll fly in on an airplane and they'll land at the airport, and then there will be some kind of party there of dignitaries to meet them. You know, yeah. If the president goes somewhere, the Pope goes somewhere, there's going to be this party of dignitaries to meet them. Well, they had something like that in the first century, only they didn't have airports. So what they would do is, and there was, this was a well-established custom, if you had someone like a king or a visiting general or something like that who's visiting your town, you've got a really important person coming, what you do is, since there's no airport to meet him at, you go out on the road to meet him. And so you might even go 2-3 days down the road in order to meet him, to show how much you care about him coming to visit you. The more, you know, the farther you go to meet him, the more it indicates you care. And then when he comes, you escort him back to town. And classical Bible scholars, Protestant and Catholic alike, agree that's what Paul's talking about here, that the dead who are buried in the earth and the living who are on the surface of the earth will be caught up to meet Jesus as he's coming back to reign, and then they escort him back to earth. And so a historical, and I would say correct, understanding of the rapture is it's something that happens at the second coming, where both the living and the dead Christians get caught up to meet Jesus and then escort him back to where he's going to reign. There is still a difference of opinion among Christians about, well, is he going to reign for 1,000 years on earth before the end, or is this the end and he's going to reign on the new heavens and the new earth? But that's the basic correct understanding of the rapture.
That takes us to a break. So we will depart momentarily, come back. I want to find out about the 3 days of darkness and the illumination of conscience and some of the things that lots of people talk about, particularly in Catholic circles, related to the second coming of Jesus. We'll do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Carry the faith wherever you go. Catch up with the latest news from Washington, D.C., the Vatican, and the world on all of our EWTN news platforms, such as the National Catholic Register, Catholic News Agency, EWTN News Nightly, EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, and EWTN News In-Depth. Download the EWTN app at EWTNApps.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Talking about the end of the world, about the second coming, the rapture, all that stuff, all collected up into a general topic title, maybe called the eschaton, which we've also discussed. Jimmy, you were talking about the rapture, and I want to talk to you.
Eschaton isn't good, Brandon, because nobody speaks Greek these days.
Yeah, that's
unless true. It might work in if you go to Greece, but yeah, you know,
that's a good point.
I did have something I wanted to just mention on the rapture. I have an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World I recently did on it, where I go into a lot more detail than I just did now. It's episode 357. And so you can go to my YouTube channel and search my channel, as opposed to searching YouTube. But you can search my channel for rapture, or you can go to mysterious.fm /357 since it's episode 357.
All right. Check it out. Well, let me just kind of, because you did talk about the millennium and all that in being involved in that general kind of Schofield rapture mm-hmm. theology. So let me just get a clear sense from you then. Is there a literal thousand-year reign, a millennium?
Well, it's going to depend on what you mean.
Okay.
So there's this passage in Revelation 20. It's at the beginning of Revelation 20, where it talks about Jesus and the saints reigning for 1,000 years. Now, and there have been basically three different positions that have been taken on this in church history. Catholics tend not to use these names, but because it distinguishes the three positions nicely, I'll use them. One position is known as premillennialism. And this position says we are before the millennium right now. That's why it's called, not only are we before the millennium, but also Christ will return bodily before the millennium. And that's not the same thing as the rapture theory, because remember, the rapture theory is the way the term is commonly used is Jesus takes the believers back up to heaven. And you don't have to assume that. You could assume, you know, that they're going to escort him back down to earth to reign on earth for 1,000 years. And that's what's known as historic premillennialism, as opposed to dispensational premillennialism that involves the rapture. It's called premillennialism because Christ comes back before the millennium. That's what inaugurates the millennium on this model. Then there's another view called postmillennialism. And postmillennialism says that the millennium is going to happen before the second coming. And then so we'll have a millennium where Christ is reigning from heaven, and then Jesus will come back. And so the idea in postmillennialism is we're not in the millennium yet, but there will be this future golden age where Christianity, not entirely, but largely permeates the world. And it's this kind of great golden age. And then at the end of that is kind of the climactic triumph. Christ will come back at the end. And so that's postmillennialism. Then there's and both premillennialism and postmillennialism have been minority positions in Christian history. The majority opinion, and this is true of individuals like St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, Luther, and Calvin, is a position called amillennialism. Now, that term is, everyone agrees it's a misleading term, because in Greek, a means not. And so amillennialism, based on its word parts, would be no millennialism. And that is, everyone agrees that is not what amillennialists believe. They don't think there's going to be no millennium. Instead, they think that the millennium is equivalent to either the entire church age or almost the entire church age. So we are living in the millennium right now. And then at the end of the – so it's different than postmillennialism, which says the millennium is still in our future. No, we're in it right now. But it's also like postmillennialism in that Jesus will come back at the end of the millennium. There will be this unleashing of the forces of evil. Jesus will come back, and then we'll have the resurrection of the dead and judgment day and the beginning of the eternal order. So those are sort of the three positions on the millennium. And in terms of the Catholic understanding of things, it's, even though Catholics tend not to use the term amillennialism, it's the Catholic position is basically amillennialism. The idea is we're in this age right now where Christ is reigning in heaven with the saints. The devil has been bound in such a way that he can't deceive the nations by stopping the spread of the gospel. And so today, you know, a third of the world population is Christian, which is dramatically different. And half of the world population worships the God of Abraham. So we're in this situation that's just dramatically different than the first century, when there was this tiny number of Christians, just a few thousand, and the world was otherwise swallowed in pagan darkness. So, you know, it looks like, okay, things aren't going too great for the devil. You know, I mean, no matter what bad things he's able to do, like abortion and advertising, in terms of fundamental commitment to God, things are better now than they've ever been in world history. And so many Christian scholars historically and today would say that's what's going on. We're in the millennium right now, but eventually it'll end and there'll be an unleashing of the forces of evil. And maybe we're getting close to that. Maybe that's why abortion and advertising have come along. But that's been the majority position, including not only among Catholics, but also among the Protestant reformers.
We have to take a quick break for our advertisers.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully none of them are abortionists. No,
well, certainly not. As a matter of fact, I know quite well some of them are working exactly against that. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We want to talk about, when we come back, about where in the Bible we would find items like the 3 days of darkness, the illumination of conscience. Then we'll get into the Antichrist. Who he is? Is it a he? Maybe talk about the mark of the beast. Is that related to Mr. Beast? All of that to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin Podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. I don't know if that's is it appropriate to have groovy music when we're talking about the end times? Is that?
Hey, it's the end of the world, and I feel fine.
Okay, as long as you feel fine, Jimmy. You and Michael Stipe, you are the two that feel fine about all this. I can't remember if I... Oh, you were talking about advertising and abortion when we left.
Oh, so, yeah. That I thought I'd explain that. That's a reference to... That's another movie reference.
I did not know that.
Yeah. In 1967, there was a movie that came out called Bedazzled, starring the British comedians Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. Now, there's a more recent and, I gather, much inferior version that came out. But the original 1967 version of Bedazzled is the one I've seen. And in it, Peter Cook plays the devil. And Dudley Moore plays an ordinary Christian who's having a little bit of a crisis of faith. And he asks God to give him a sign that'll strengthen his faith. And then he meets the devil. And over the course of the movie, his faith ends up getting strengthened. So he gets his prayer request. But as he's talking to the devil, so the devil, he grants him like seven wishes or something. And every wish, because it's like the monkey's paw, you know, which is a story where wishes go bad. All of Dudley Moore's wishes go bad. And at the end of each wish, when he's sick of it, he blows a raspberry. He just goes, and then he's instantly teleported to where the devil is and they can talk about it. So he keeps trying to get the right wish, and it's not working for him. But he has quite a number of these conversations with the devil, and he meets the devil interacting with a number of the devil's servants, who are the seven deadly sins. So there's anger and envy and gluttony, who's a really fat woman, and Raquel Welch plays lust. And the devil at one point is talking about how he's at a tactical disadvantage to God, you know, because God is everywhere. And the devil says, I'm only highly mobile.
Yeah.
But he also is talking about how things have really gone downhill for him, because he says, the seven deadly sins, I thought them up in one afternoon. The only thing I've come up with lately is advertising. So
with modern advertising has been very helpful to the devil, as a matter of fact. All right, well, let me ask you about the 3 days of darkness. This is something that many Catholics, it's part of the Catholic discourse. I do not know, just because I don't know, if it's part of Protestant discourse, but it's not at all. Okay.
Totally not.
So which part of the Bible is this in?
None of them.
Okay. So tell me about the 3 days.
The 3 days of darkness are not predicted in the Bible anywhere. Now, if you go on some websites for 3 days of darkness supporters, they will appeal to passages like Exodus, where you have the 10 plagues against Egypt, and one of them is a plague of darkness. Or they'll mention that in the book of Revelation, there's a plague of darkness at one point. But none of these, Exodus, that's all in our past.
Yeah.
That is not a prophecy of the future. And so it provides zero support, evidentially. And it doesn't indicate, 3 days anyway. It doesn't provide support for there's going to be this future 3 days of darkness. And neither does the book of Revelation. Also, Revelation, if you interpret it correctly, if we're living in the millennium right now, that means all the stuff before Revelation 20 is most plausibly understood as applying to our past. The first century or the first few Christian centuries. And so it likely applies to our past as well. So we don't have any biblical passages at all that talk about there's going to be a future event in our future where there's going to be 3 days of darkness that cover the earth. So this is an idea that doesn't come from the Bible. It comes from alleged private revelations.
Okay. Is that also the case with the thing that is often associated with that is the illumination of conscience, which I understand to be people will see their own soul as God sees it?
Yes, that also is something. There is nothing in the Bible saying that we're going to have an illumination of conscience at some future moment, everyone in the world all at once. This event is also sometimes called the warning. That is not derived from biblical revelation. It is something that is based on alleged private revelations.
All right. What about the concept of Antichrist? Is that a biblical concept?
That is a biblical concept, but there's more to say about it than you might think. I'd like to go back and touch a little bit on the 3 days of darkness and the illumination of conscience, because I've done a good bit of work on both of those.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
There is an episode, and I'll just give you the episode number up front before I summarize, but there is an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World where I looked at the warning or the illumination of conscience event, and it's episode 122, as I recall correctly. Yes, it's episode 122. And so you can go to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/Jimmy Akin and search the channel, not YouTube, for warning or illumination of conscience, and it should come up. You can also go to mysterious.fm/122 and get it that way. But basically, And I've also written an article about the 3 days of darkness, which is at Catholic.com. So if you Google 3 days of darkness, Jimmy Akin, it'll come up. And what you'll see in both the episode on the Warning and the 3 days of darkness article is I do what most supporters of these events never do. I go back and I look at the sources that are being cited. One of the things that you find when you study events in this kind of area is that the web pages or books that talk about them are terribly sourced. There is a kind of copy and paste-itis where someone will find a quote in, let's say it's a book, and they'll just copy it and paste it onto their website, and there's no source. And so when you try to investigate, like, okay, so if this is based on private revelation, who said it? You know, what private revelations? I want to read what the seers wrote. And you find that there that the sourcing is terrible. And frequently, it even when there is a source, it's very, very dubious. I mean, for, oftentimes, they will misinterpret stuff. For example, when it comes to the illumination of conscience, one of the things you'll say is you'll hear is, "Oh, Saint Edmund Campion supported this," and sometimes they'll even have a little quote, but from Saint Edmund Campion. But when you go and you look it up, you find out this Saint Edmund Campion was not talking about an event in the future where everyone's conscience is going to be illuminated together prior to the last day, which is what the illumination of conscience is supposed to be. It's like before the second coming, before the end of the world, God's going to give everyone this warning of by letting them see themselves in the light of their sins and God's mercy. But this is before the second coming. That's why it's a warning. It's not the final judgment. But when you look up the quote from St. Edmund Campion, he was a Jesuit at the time of the Protestant Reformation in England, and he was an underground priest. You know, it was illegal to be a Catholic priest, and if they caught you, they would kill you, which is what happened to St. Edmund Campion. They caught him, and then they killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And this quote actually comes from his trial, where he was accused of saying there's going to be this great day when the King of Spain is going to march in and smash all these evil Protestants in England. And he's like, no, that's not what I've said. The only great day I've promised doesn't involve any earthly potentate like the King of Spain. I'm talking about Judgment Day, just like every Protestant preacher doth. And so there is going to be a reckoning day coming, but it's going to be when Jesus judges our own hearts on Judgment Day. And that's what St. Edmund Campion is talking about. But because people in the apparition rumor net don't look up sources, they just, oh, that's a juicy quote, let's go with that, they end up misrepresenting, even when there is a quote, they end up misrepresenting what was said. Similarly, there are other problems with the sources, like for both the Warning and the 3 days of darkness, one of the figures that gets cited is Blessed Anna Maria Taigi, depending on how you want to pronounce her last name. And she was an Italian mystic a while back, not in like the 17th and 18th century, as I recall. Maybe 19th, but her alleged quotations are things that on these subjects are not things that she can be documented to have said in her life. Instead, what they are is quotations attributed to her spiritual director, who didn't even talk about these things until 25 years after she's dead. So we're dealing with an elderly spiritual director and relying on his memory and his honesty about what she said much earlier. We have no way of knowing exactly what she said. We don't have an exact quotation. It's just, well, I think she said something like this. And yet it gets presented as blessed, Anna Maria Taiji said this. There also are quotations that are entirely fake. A famous one was attributed to Padre Pio, and even when he was alive. And his own order has said, no, he never said anything like that. But this quotation from him is still out there on the apparition rumor net, mm-hmm. as Padre Pio said this. And so, bottom line, none of these are approved private revelations. In some cases, they're attributed to people who are saints and blesseds, but none of these statements are part of a private revelation that has been investigated and approved as supernatural. Many of them are misunderstood. They're talking about something else, like with St. Edmund Campion, he was talking about Judgment Day. Others are total frauds, like the one attributed to Padre Pio, and others are unknowable because they're not traceable directly to the seer. We just have a claim that somebody remembers the person saying something like this more than 25 years ago. And so I just urge caution mm-hmm. on both of these things. They are not in the Bible, and the sources for them are really, really sketchy.
All right. You did, however, say before we return to those topics that the Antichrist is biblical. We'll talk about the Antichrist, yep. the Whore of Babylon, the man of lawlessness. Let's get into some of that when we get back. Jimmy Akin going through everything we can ask him in 2 hours about the end of the world on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
She is one of the most beloved saints of all time, honored as the saint of the little way.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thérèse of Lisieux entered the Carmelite convent of Lisieux in 1888 and survived only 9 more years. Still, her extraordinary holiness and prayer life prompted her superiors to have her write an autobiography, The Story of a Soul. It became a spiritual classic.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm just going to give Jimmy the easy questions. We're talking about the end of the world. We'll get to all the easy ones now. Is the Antichrist alive now, and who is it? What?
There are many Antichrists alive right now, and I probably name bunches of them, because anybody who is against Christ is an Antichrist in that sense.
So what am I to make of, like, I guess, what's the image or what is the meaning, the biblical meaning of Antichrist? Is it the same as St. Paul's man of lawlessness? And what data do we actually have about the Antichrist?
Okay. So there are three figures in the New Testament that are often conflated. One of them is St. Paul's man of lawlessness or man of sin. The second is the beast from the sea in the book of Revelation.
Oh, yeah.
And the third is the Antichrist. But each of these is mentioned in different places, and we need to understand them distinctly. We need to take each text on its own terms before we try, rather than just assuming they're all the same thing. Maybe they're the same thing, maybe they're not. We need to find that out. We need to look at each passage on its own, or each book that mentions them on its own, before we try to figure out how they're related to each other, if they're related to each other than being bad guys. So, in the case of the Antichrist is mentioned in four passages in the New Testament, and all of them are in the writings of St. John. Specifically, they're all in the Joannine letters.
Okay.
So you find a discussion of the Antichrist in 1 John, and you also find a discussion of the Antichrist in one of the other two Joannine letters as well. The major passage that discusses the Antichrist is one where John says, "You have heard that Antichrist is coming, and this is true." In fact, he says, "Many Antichrists have come." So the way this makes it sound, there is some future reality that John calls the Antichrist, but it's not 100% clear, is this future reality a person, a human person, or is it something else? Because he indicates there are these other Antichrists that have already showed up in the first century, and so presumably they're around too. Well, what would the Antichrist be? Well, anti is a Greek preposition that can mean, sometimes it means substitute, but it also, its more basic meaning is just against. And Christos is the Greek word for Christ. So antichristos would mean someone who's against Christ. Some people have tried to argue it means substitute Christ, but that doesn't seem to really go along with how John uses the term, because what he says about these antichrists is that they deny that Jesus has come in the flesh. So they deny the incarnation of the Son of God, and that makes it sound like, okay, they're just against Christ if they're saying he never was born in the flesh. And so anybody today who would be against Christ or who would deny that the Son of God became incarnate, that person could be understood as an antichrist. And John indicates that some of these antichrists started in the Christian community, but then they left.
Okay.
And which at least left in the sense of they became heretics. So, for example, there was a heresy in the early church known as Docetism. And dokein is Greek for to seem. And what the Docetists claimed was that Jesus wasn't really a man. He just seemed to be a man. And so that's why they're called the Seemers or the Docetists. And you can see how that would go along with what John is describing here. They were part of the Christian community, but they've gone out from us because they deny that Jesus has come in the flesh. They think he just seemed to have flesh. And so you can see how those concepts could relate. But that doesn't really answer for us the question of what about the coming Antichrist? That's open, what that's going to be. It might be a man. It might be a movement. It might be a movement led by a man, since movements tend to have leaders. And it's something that we don't really learn a whole lot about in the Joannine letters where the term is actually used. So what people tend to do is they tend to conflate what John says in his letters with these other passages. Like in the Thessalonian letters, Paul talks about the man of sin. In the book of Revelation, John talks about the beast from the sea. And they assume these are all the same thing, but it's really hard to show that from what John says about the Antichrist. Now, the church has picked up the term Antichrist, and it uses it for something that will happen. Again, like I said, if you want to find this, it's around paragraph 676 in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. But it uses the term Antichrist to refer to a reality that will be present in the great final persecution of the church. But the Catechism is deliberately ambiguous about, is it a person or is it a movement? And those two are not in conflict because it could be both a person and a movement. But because we know so little about the Antichrist, since there are only these four references to him, we have to be kind of cautious about what we claim about the Antichrist. And rather than lumping the man of lawlessness and the beast from the sea under the same heading, I want to keep them separate and let each passage speak on its own.
All right. I don't want to get to end the hour without asking you a question about summing up the whole thing. And there are many, many things we can get to. Clearly, I'm glad you said that we could do in 2 hours, because there's a lot. When I think now that I'm thinking about it, even the answers you've given raise other questions or ideas that I'd like to address. But I would like to leave.
Have me back to talk about them.
Yes, let's do that. And but I would like you to not leave without some summing up and some direction for us. So what are we supposed to do with this information? Often symbolic and sometimes ambiguous about the end times. What is it? What can we say, summing up what the church teaches about the end times, and what are we supposed to do with that information?
Well, one of the things that I think we can say, as we mentioned to start out these 2 hours, is we're living in the end times, and we have been for the last 2,000 years. Okay. So we don't know how long they're going to go on. So what should our attitude be? Well, we know we're in the last times, but we don't know how long they're going to go on. It could be, since the final end is unpredictable, it's going to come like a thief in the night. We need to be ready for that. And so we need to follow Jesus's advice. He uses the metaphor of sleep, and he says, watch, meaning stay awake. So morally speaking, we need to stay awake. And we need to live lives of godliness. Put it another way, since, you know, God's kingdom has been inaugurated and now Christ's enemies are being defeated, we need to, as John the Baptist and Jesus said, repent and believe the gospel. And if we fall into sin again, we need to repent again. And if we lose our faith, we need to repent of that and believe in the gospel. We also want to share the gospel with others and thus help build Christ's kingdom in that way. We're forewarned that, you know, the future is going to contain some pretty hard bumps, but those bumps may or may not arrive in our day. So we want to be trusting of God, regardless of what specifically is going to happen in our time. We want to be aware of, you know, the things that will happen in the future, but we don't want to obsess about them because we don't know that they're going to happen in our day. Also, the fact that so many Christians have just been wrong about what they've claimed about the last day means we need to be very careful here. We need to be cautious. We need to not make sweeping claims and leap to exciting conclusions. There have been a lot of people who've terrified others. I remember a few years ago, there was a Canadian priest named Father Michel Rodrigue who was given some talks that were on YouTube, and they were incredibly popular, and they absolutely terrified people because he was claiming to be a major visionary and he was talking about the end of the world and it's all going to start happening, the warning's going to happen within the next 3 months and stuff. And he made specific prophecies. Now, I looked into him. I did a whole episode of Mysterious World about him. It's episode 123. He was a big warning illumination of conscience guy. And so I looked at that in one episode. And then in the next episode, I looked at Michel Rodrigue. And he, I concluded, was a fabulist, meaning he told fables. He falsified his own biography. He claimed things happened in his life that if they had happened, they would be easy to find in the news. You know, and so he was a self-aggrandizing fabulist who indicated, I'm this special person in God's plan and everyone needs to listen to me. And he made specific predictions about Pope Benedict and Pope Francis that have all been falsified now. And I said ahead of time, these are going to be falsified, and they were. Also, he was condemned, as I was preparing the episode, he was condemned by both of his bishops in Canada. But he had been terrifying people, and that's what caused his bishops to crack down on him. And that's what caused me to devote a whole episode to him. Like I said, it's episode 123, so you can get to it by going to mysterious.fm/123. Very easy number to remember. But because people often take these kind of things with an immediacy, especially the more dramatic claims, with a kind of immediacy of, oh, this is all about to happen in our lifetime, and that kind of prediction has a terrible record of coming true, just relax. Don't assume that we're at the very end itself. I know we're at the very end of the show, but we're not at the very end of the world. And just trust God and love Him and love others, and you'll be ready for whatever comes.
Be ready. Be ready. But that means the doing what Christ called us to do, the sacramental life, the life of charity, forgiving from our hearts, having faith, all those things. Those are the things that it takes to be ready, yes?
Yep.
All right. Let's do that. It is funny. It doesn't mean we're at the end and then the music starts to play. Well, in one sense, we are at the end. That's as many questions as we were able to get in 2 hours. We are going to have to do this again. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. Check out the Jimmy Akin podcast and Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on Jimmy's YouTube channel. And we will see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.